so he wouldn't have to work alone. I had this whole idea I was going to unearth the real Harold. Only I did, and it was as nasty as the rest of them. We were doing dishes together for Mrs. Held in the cafeteria one day, and all of a sudden he stuck his hand down my shorts. When I asked him what the fuck he was doing, he said there was no reason for me to be picky about who I screwed, since the whole human race was going down the toilet anyway. I shoved him so hard his glasses fell off and broke again. So that was Harold. Nick was looking from face to face with great, fascinated eyes. His cocoa was mostly gone, and there was a smear of chocolate around his mouth, and he was the most Norman Rockwell thing Harper had ever seen. He showed Allie something he had written on his placemat. She borrowed his pencil to reply. Nick nodded, then bent, wrote something more, and pushed it across to Harper. I tried to warn Allie she couldn't trust him. He used to make his nastiest butt smoke whenever he was around her. Deaf people can smell things most people can't, and I could smell the evil in it. Harper turned the placemat so Renee could read it. Renee looked at it and looked up at Harper, and the two of them erupted into laughter. Harper quaked, surprised at the force of her own jollity. She felt unaccountably close to tears. Nick watched them with bewilderment. She had a swallow from her mug to calm herself down, then felt a bubble of hilarity rising in her again, and almost coughed coffee back up her nostrils. Renee pounded her on the back until her choking fit had passed. Don read what Nick had written, and one corner of his mouth lifted in a wry smile. Funny, that. I never smelt evil on him, but I smelt something else on him once. And in a way, that was the first domino in the chain that led to him getting killed. Harold took a job working under my direction, digging up bloodworms for bait. It was funny, him volunteering for a physical job. Kind of like the Queen offering to scrub out toilets. No one else wanted him, though, so I took him on my crew. He told me he knew a spot south of camp, a marshy flat where the bloodworms were easy to find. He knowed what he was talking about, too. Lots of days he'd come back with more bait than any of the other boys I sent out digging. But then other days he'd show up with maybe two worms in his bucket and just shrug and say his luck was bad. Well, I figured on those days he was going off to nap somewheres and didn't worry myself too much about it. Till one day, middle of August, he shows up with nothing. And as he's putting down his empty pail, he lets a burp slip. And goddamn if I don't smell pizza on his fackin' breath. That didn't sit easy with me. You may have noticed, pizza ain't on the menu here in Camp Wyndham. I slept an uneasy sleep, and the next day, I decided I had to pass a word along to Ben Patchett. Ben wasn't no more happy about it than I was. He got real stiff and pale and sat rubbing his mouth a while, and finally he said he was glad I spoke up. Then he asked me if I'd mind making Michael a part of my bait team for a week. I knew what Mikey was going to be digging for, and it wasn't worms, but we had to find out what Cross was up to, so I said, "Aye, yeah." Well, Mikey took to trailing him at a distance. The first few days, the worst thing he seen Harold do was take a dump and use the pages from one of the camp library books for toilet paper. Renee winced. It turned out to be The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, our only copy. If I had known what he was going to do with it, I would have given him a copy of Atlas Shrugged. On the fourth day, though, our boy Mike followed Harold to an abandoned summer cottage a half mile away, place with a generator and internet. The boy is in there on a laptop, typing emails with one hand and cramming down a pepperoni hot pocket with the other. Not only was Harold right back to the same tricks, spilling our secrets to the same people, but he had a whole deep freezer full of chow he was keeping to his own self. Don passed the job of telling the story to Allie with a sidelong look. She nodded and went on. I was there when Mike showed up. This was over at the House of the Black Star, where my aunt lives with Granddad. This wasn't so long after my mom passed away. Allie spoke quietly, neither hiding her pain nor making a display of it. Aunt Carol had some of Mom's things, and she asked me to look through them and see if there was anything I wanted for Nick and myself. There wasn't anything, really, except this. She touched a finger to the book-shaped gold locket at her throat. When Mike came in and said what he had seen, we stopped what we were doing, and Granddad sent me to find Mr. Patchett. By the time I got back with Ben, Aunt Carol was sitting in a chair with her face in her hands, and she had gray threads of smoke coming off her. She was so stressed. She said we needed to force Harold out of camp. But Mr. Patchett said that would be the worst thing we could do. If we sent Harold away and he got picked up by a quarantine patrol, they'd make him tell everything he knew about us. Mr. Patchett wanted to lock Harold up somewhere, but Granddad said it would be enough to make Harold promise to remain on campgrounds and stop contacting outsiders. Carol and Mr. Patchett gave each other this look like, which of us is going to tell him that's the most senile thing he's ever said? But the thing about my granddad is, it's kind of hard to convince him people won't just do the right thing. You hate to say anything that sounds hostile or untrusting or small-hearted around him. You feel like he'd be disappointed in you. Mr. Patchett gave in. He got Granddad to agree to keep Harold under close watch, and that was it. Allie put her elbows on the table and rested her chin in the cradle of her hands. She wasn't looking at any of them now, had lowered her gaze to stare disconsolately inward. Harper felt they had just about come to it now. The end of Harold Cross's story, which also happened to be the end of Harold Cross. At last she went on. After Mr. Patchett confronted Harold about what he had been up to, Harold came down with stomach pains and took himself to the infirmary. Mr. Patchett made sure there was always a lookout stationed there, day and night, to make sure Harold didn't wander off. If they weren't stationed right in the ward with him, they were in the waiting room. When it happened, it was on my shift, during the day, when the whole camp was asleep. At some point near the end of my watch, around dusk, I had to pee, and the only way to get to the bathroom is to walk across the ward. I crept through on tiptoe, real careful, trying not to wake Harold up. He was in one of the partitioned-off sleeping areas. I could just see him under his sheets, through a crack between the hanging curtains. I had almost made it to the bathroom when my hip bumped a bedpan and it fell with a loud bang. Harold didn't even roll over. Suddenly I got a cold, sick feeling, and I pulled aside the curtain to have a closer look at him. It was just pillows under the sheets. She looked up and met Harper's eyes, and her gaze was wounded and ashamed. See, I was asleep most of the afternoon, while I was supposed to be on guard in the waiting room. I told myself it wasn't hurting anyone. I figured if Harold tried to sneak out past me, I'd hear him. I thought I was too light a sleeper for him to get by me. Some light sleeper. I must have been in a low-grade coma. Maybe Norma Held slipped a roofie into my tea, hoping to get lucky with me. The corner of her mouth tweaked up in a little smile, but her chin trembled. Don put a leathery hand on the back of her neck and gave her a gentle, awkward sort of pat.
You ever think if you woke up when he was trying to sneak out, he might have belted you one? He was going out that door, one way or t'other.
Harold couldn't fight his way past Nick, Allie said, brushing roughly at her eyes with the back of one hand.
Who says he would have fought? He might have called you into the ward and then socked you with a wrench. No, ma'am. He was going to depart our company by hook or by crook. It was mad to think we could hold him prisoner without locking him up. I'd fist fight sharks for your grandpap, but he was wrong about how to handle Harold, and Ben Patchett was right.
Nick had noticed Allie rubbing at her eyes. He scribbled something on the placemat. Allie read it and shook her head. No, I don't want your last marshmallow. He wrote something else, then stuck a spoon in his mug and dredged out part of a melted marshmallow. Allie sighed and opened her mouth and let him feed her. He says it's medicine for misery, Allie told them in a muffled sort of way, chewing gummy marshmallow. A bright tear skipped down one cheek. It does make me feel better, actually. Don Lewiston leaned in, elbows on the table.
I can tell you the rest, I suppose, quick enough. Allie got Mike, and Mikey ran for Ben Patchett. My cot is next to Ben's, and all their whispering woke me up. When I heard they were all setting out to see if they could bring Harold back, I offered to go with him. Maybe I felt like I had to go. Harold had been part of my crew. My lack of supervision is what gave him the chance to get back in contact with the outside world. I don't remember who went and got a rifle from the range, but I think it was on all our minds. Harold might not come back of his own free will. I remember this one, he patted Allie's shoulder, was told to stay here. As you might guess, that did about as much good as shouting at clouds. We covered probably 3 miles of hard trail in 20 minutes, making a beeline for Harold's little hideaway, and Allie was out in front the whole way, and it was still a damned close thing. When we got there, it was pretty much the worst-case scenario. Maybe some of the people Harold had been emailing with were who they said they were, Maybe most of them were. But one of them wasn't. When we got to the cabin, there was a van parked out front and men with guns. Not a state-run quarantine patrol. Cremation fellas. We saw the whole thing from behind this old stone wall that was out behind the cabin. They had Bushmaster rifles and were thumping Harold with the butts, shoving him around, having fun. Harold was down in the dirt, clutching his laptop and begging them not to kill him. He was saying he wasn't dangerous, that he could control his infection. He was telling them he could lead them to a hiding place where there were lots of people who could control the dragon scale. That was when Ben asked Mikey if the rifle was loaded. "I thought we were going to fight for Harold," Allie said, "like on a TV show. 4 of us against 12 of them. Pretty stupid, huh?" Her voice was rough and strained, and Harper was conscious of Allie trying to restrain her tears. Mikey's hands were shaking so hard he spilled bullets all over the ground. But Ben, he turned into a different man altogether. He was a cop in his former life, you know. You could see the cop in his face. He went calm, but he also went hard. He said, "You better let me do this, son," and took the rifle out of Mikey's hands. He put the first one in Harold's throat. He put the second in the laptop. The cremation crew hit the dirt, and for all I know, they're lying there still, because we got up and ran like hell and never looked back. His coffee was gone. He rolled his mug back and forth between his palms. Ben Patchett looked icy enough out in the woods, but when he got back, he cried his eyes out. Sat on one of the pews with Father Story holding him like a child. Father Story shushed him and rubbed his back and told him if it was anyone's fault, it was his own, not Ben's. Nick was frowning, writing on the placemat again. He pushed it to Allie, who read it, then turned it toward Renee and Harper so they could read it. "Mr. Patchett shouldn't have sent someone to get a rifle. He should have sent someone to get John. He could have saved Harold." "Maybe so," Don said, who was reading the placemat upside down. "We were in a hell of a rush, though, and it was a good thing we moved fast, as it turned out. If we were even 2 minutes slower, Harold might have coughed it all up. Then instead of one dead kid, we'd have a camp full of dead kids, and dead grown-ups, too." He set his mug down on the table with a glassy clink. People were up on their feet, filling the room with a lot of loud, happy conversation. It was time for chapel. Harper felt the familiar bunched knot of dread tightening in her stomach. Another song was coming, another harmony she wouldn't be able to join, another overwhelming blast of noise and light. "I guess that's all of it," Renee said. "The sad ballad of Harold Cross." Harper didn't want to go, and so when she spoke, it was more to stall for time than anything else. "Maybe not quite all. There is one thing I'm wondering about. What was in his notebook? Did anyone ever find out?"
"I've wondered that myself," Don said, getting to his feet. "It never turned up. Maybe he had it on him when he was killed. If so, it didn't reveal the location of camp, or this whole place would be burnt to the ground by now."
He clucked his tongue, shook his head.
"I don't expect we'll ever know. Some mysteries ain't ever gonna be solved."
December 10. Two sisters, Gail and Jillian Neighbors, were having a spat. They shared a single bottle of red nail polish, which had gone missing, and each accused the other of losing it or maybe hoarding it. They were twins and barbaric with each other by nature. Jillian already had a twisted nipple, and when Harper separated them, Gail was clutching a dirty sock to a bloody nose. Jillian had jammed her thumb at least an inch up one nostril. Harper patrolled the dorm, asking around. It felt good to think about someone else's problems, better than worrying about lights out when she would lie in her cot, desperate to sleep and sick at the thought of what might happen when she did. She figured Allie would know who, if anyone, might have helped themselves to the nail polish. The shade was called incendiary, which the neighbor's twins didn't seem to realize was funny. Allie and another girl were playing rummy on a stack of suitcases. Harper wandered over and stood behind this other girl, Jamie Close, and waited to be noticed.
"I'm glad I'm not sleeping next to her," Jamie Close was saying to Allie.
Jamie was one of the older lookouts, 19 going on 20. She had close-set eyes and an upturned nose, which conspired together to give her an unfortunate swinish mien.
Sleeping next to who? Allie asked absentmindedly over her cards.
You know, Nurse Sunshine, Jamie went on. She woke up coughing smoke last night. Did you hear her? I'm like, burn already so some of us can sleep. I'm like...
Allie stepped on Jamie's foot hard. A child might have imagined it was an accident. A very small, very naive child. Jamie stiffened and went silent. After a moment, Allie's gaze drifted up and she appeared to see Harper for the first time.
Hey, what's going on, Nurse Willows?
The neighbor's twins lost a bottle of nail polish, just asking around to see if either of you might have seen it. Jamie Close sat rigidly on an upturned bucket. Her T-shirt was hiked up to show the tramp stamp on the small of her back, a tattoo of the Confederate flag above the word rebel. She didn't have the nerve to look back at Harper.
Sorry, ma'am. I don't do nothing with my nails but chew on them.
Allie looked like she wanted to say something. Her eyes were apologetic and worried, but she just opened her mouth and closed it and shook her head. Harper smiled effortfully, thanked them, and walked away. Her dragon scale pulsed with a disagreeable warmth in a way that made her think of someone breathing on coals.
11. She dreamt she wore a gown of wasps and woke when they began to sting. The basement was stuffy and dim in the late morning, and she lay motionless, still feeling wasp stung, on her collarbone, on the inside of her left thigh, between two of her toes. Harper pressed her chin into her chest, looking down, and saw a red spot burning through her T-shirt above her left breast, as if someone were pressing the tip of a cigarette into the cotton, from the inside. A silky thread of white smoke trickled up from the growing burn. Harper watched, in a state of horrible lassitude, as the hole expanded, the edges of bright orange lacework. At last she rubbed it out with her thumb and brushed the sparks off her chest. Her body throbbed from nearly a dozen of those wasp-sting burns. She flapped back her blanket to see if her clothes were burning anywhere else, and a gush of black smoke drifted toward the ceiling. She was reminded of her childhood fascination with smoke signals. What would this message translate to? Probably, "Help! I am going to be burned alive!"
Enough, she thought. She sat up very carefully, iron bedsprings creaking. She did not want to wake anyone, did not want to cause any trouble. In those first moments, she was not clear about what she meant to do, only that she didn't want to have to talk to anyone about it. That enough indicated some kind of decision, but it was not immediately clear to her what she had decided. In the next bed, Renee slept on her side, deep in her own dreams, smiling at some imagined event. Harper half had an urge to lean over and kiss her forehead, to have one final moment of physical contact.
Final moment?
Harper found she couldn't look at Renee for long. Enough represented some kind of betrayal of their friendship. Enough was going to hurt Renee, would leave her, what? Bereft was the word that came to mind. Bereft and enough went together like bride and groom. Harper considered packing the portable mother and her clothes into her carpet bag, but enough was a destination that required no baggage. Enough was a reverberation deep inside her, a kind of ringing emptiness, as if she were a steeple in which a bell had been solemnly struck. Ask not for whom it tolls. She rose and paced across the cool, dusty concrete. Harper paused at the bottom of the steps for a look back at the maze of cots, a labyrinth of sleeping women. In that moment she loved them all, even awful Jamie Close with her ugly mouth and upturned nose. Harper had always wanted a tough friend like Jamie, someone rude and mouthy, who would cut a bitch for talking smack. She loved Renee and the neighbor's girls, and little Emily Waterman, and Allie, and Nick. Nick, most of all, with his bottle glass green eyes and articulate hands, which drew words on the air like a boy wizard sketching spells. She climbed three steps to the door, eased the latch up with a click, and slipped out. She blinked at the watery sunlight. She hadn't seen any in a while, and it hurt her eyes. The sky was high and pale, like the dingy canvas roof of a circus tent. She went up more steps, trailing wisps of smoke behind her. The scale had burned holes in her sweats, holes all through her rent T-shirt. She had seen Rent with Jacob, and he had held her hand while she wept at the end. She was surprised to find herself longing for Jacob now, for the wiry strength of his arms when he held her around the waist. It didn't seem to matter that the last time she had seen him, he had been waving a gun at her. She supposed Jacob had been right. It would have been much easier to do things his way. He had known how awful it would be to burn to death. He had only wanted to spare her. For that she had carved open his face with a broken glass and wasted their special bottle of wine. Harper had told herself she was staying alive for the baby, but the baby never had anything to do with it, not really. She was holding on because she could not bear to say goodbye to her life and every good thing in it. She had selfishly wanted more. She had wanted to hold her father again and smell his Eight and Bob cologne, which always made her think of sea-soaked rope. She had wanted to sit by a swimming pool somewhere, with the sun glowing on her mostly bare skin, drifting half awake while her mother gabbed on and on about all the funny things Stephen Colbert had said on TV the night before. She had wanted to read her favorite books again and revisit her best friends one more time. Harry and Ron, Bilbo and Gandalf, Hazel and Bigwig, Mary and Bert. She had wanted another good, hard, lonely cry and another pee-your-pants laughing fit. She had wanted a whole bunch more sex, although, looking back, most of her sexual history involved sleeping with men she didn't much like. She had told herself she was going on with her life because she wanted her son. She was curiously certain it was a boy. To experience some of those good things, too, so he could meet her parents, read some good books, have a girl. But in reality, her son was never going to do any of those things. He was going to die before he was even born. He was going to roast in her womb. She had lived on only to murder him. She wanted to apologize to the baby for ever conceiving him. She felt like she had already failed to keep the only promise she had ever made him. When Harper reached the top of the steps, she realized she had forgotten her shoes. But it didn't matter. The thin crust of the first snow had melted away, except for a few lumps under the pines. The wind lashed the high tangles of dead grass and ruffled the sea into sharp-edged wavelets. Harper wasn't sure she could bear the wind off the water for long, not in her thin, raggedy things, but for a few moments, anyway, she thought she could use a blast of sea air. She wasn't supposed to be out in the daytime. Ben Patchett would be upset if he knew. But Camp Wyndham was sere and cold and empty, and no one was around to see. Harper set out for the shoreline, tramping across damp, rotten grass. She paused once to inspect a white rock the size of a baby's skull, streaked with black, mica-flecked seams in a way that made her think of dragon scale. With some effort, she was able to force the large stone into one pocket of her sweats. She made her way through a band of evergreens, past the boathouse, collecting a few more interesting-looking rocks as she descended to the waterfront. Harper crooned to herself disconsolately, chanting the words to a song she had overheard some of the smaller kids shouting at each other. She wondered if they even knew the tune it was parodying. Hey, Jude. Probably not. Hey, you. Don't start to cry. If you fry now, it will be shitty. A pity if you turn into a heap, 'cause it's my turn to sweep and take out the ashes. She smiled without any pleasure at all. She had wanted to believe in Aunt Carol's miracle, had wanted so badly to believe she could sing her way out of trouble. It worked for all the others, kept them safe and filled them with contentment. And it should have worked for her, too, but it didn't, and she couldn't help it. She resented them for doing what she couldn't. She resented them for pitying her. Out here, alone in the bitterly cold, clear light of the morning, she could admit to herself that she found them repugnant when they all lit up in church. To stand among them when their eyes shone and their dragon scale pulsed was almost as awful as being fondled in a crowd by a strange hand. Of all the things she wanted over, she wanted an end to morning chapel. to the sound and the fury, the song and the light. Harper padded to the splintery expanse of the dock. Here, at the open ocean, the salty air came at her in battering, cleansing strokes. The boards, worn soft by a decade of spray and damp, felt good under her feet. She walked to the end and sat down. The stones in her pockets clunked on the pine. Harper stared out at the fireman's island, her toes trailing over the water. She dipped a big toe in and gasped, the water so cold it made the knuckles in her feet throb with pain. Someone had left a length of fraying green twine wrapped round one of the posts. She began, almost idly, to unwind it. She felt it was important not to think too closely about what she was out on the dock to do. If she looked at it straight on, she might lose her nerve. On some half-conscious level, though, she knew the cold of the ocean would be almost as unbearable as the wasp-sting sensation of the dragon scale going hot, and instinct would drive her back to the shore. But if she tied her wrists, she wouldn't be able to swim, and the cold would ease from pain to dullness soon enough. She thought she would open her eyes while she was underwater. She had always liked the blurred darkness of the aquatic world. The overcast haze thinned to the east, and she could see a streak of pale blue. She felt as clear and open as that blue sky. She felt all right. She began to loop the twine around her wrists. The breeze carried a distant cry. She hesitated and cocked her head to listen. At one end of the little island was the ruin of a single-room cottage. Only two walls still stood. The other two had collapsed along with the roof. Charred beams crisscrossed within. A second, smaller building, some kind of windowless shed, painted green with a white door, had been built on the crescent of sand that faced Camp Wyndham. It had a turf roof, and a dune had blown into a high drift against the far wall, so it half resembled a hobbit hole burrowed into the side of a hill. A tin chimney pipe vented a trickle of smoke all day and all night, but as far as Harper knew, it had never drawn any attention from the outside world. You could not scan the shoreline without seeing a dozen little coils of smoke just like it. Now, though, the chimney carried the echo of a strained, small, faraway voice. "No! No, you won't! You can't!" the fireman shouted. "You don't get to give up!" Her heart sprang like a trap. For one alarming moment, she was sure he was speaking to her. But of course he couldn't see her from inside his shed. He didn't have any idea she was there. "Haven't I done everything you wanted?" he cried, the wind catching his voice and carrying it to her clearly by some perverse trick of acoustics. "Haven't I done everything you asked? Don't you think I want to quit? But I'm still here. If I don't get to go, you don't." She felt she should run. She had no right to be hearing any of this, but she couldn't move. The fury she heard in his voice ran through her like a pole, holding her in place. A great iron clang crashed inside the shed. The door shook in its frame. She waited helplessly to see what would come next, hoping with all her heart he was not about to step outside and see her. He didn't, and there was no more. Smoke trickled peacefully from the chimney, thinning quickly as it rose into the general haze. The wind thrashed the wiry tufts of seagrass on the island. Harper listened and waited and watched until she realized she was shivering from the cold. She dropped the twine she had been tying around her wrists. A gust snatched it, floated it into the air, flicked it into the sea. Harper drew her knees to her chest, hugging them for warmth. The stone, like a baby's skull, was digging painfully into her hip, so she worked it out of her pocket and set it on the edge of the dock. Too close to the edge, the stone toppled over the side. "Bloosh!" went the sea as it swallowed the rock. It was such an agreeable sound. Harper dropped in all the other stones she had collected one by one, just to hear that sound again and again. Norma Held said there were ghosts out there, ghosts made of smoke. Maybe John had been yelling at one of them. Maybe he was yelling at shadows, or at himself. Ghosts carried messages from beyond, but they didn't seem like they would be terribly good listeners. John sounded so wretched and hurt. Harper thought someone ought to listen to him. If the ghosts wouldn't, she would. Besides, Jacob had always thought he knew what was better for her than she did. And if she killed herself, it would be admitting he was right. That alone was reason to persist, just to stick it to him. Now that she was more awake, she was feeling less forgiving about the gun. No one heard Harper letting herself back into the basement of the chapel. Her blanket smelled like a campfire, but they were so cozy she was asleep in minutes, and this time there were no dreams. 12. On the night of the first lottery to see who would eat and who wouldn't, Harper pulled kitchen duty. Norma planted Harper just beyond the serving window, behind a folding table set with thermoses and mugs and a big rectangular tin of sugar. "You can sweeten the coffee for the losers. One spoonful each, no more. And let 'em see that belly of yours. Remind 'em what they're skipping lunch for. Your precious little miracle," Norma said. This did not make Harper feel better. It made Harper feel fat, entitled, and lonesome. Of course she wasn't fat, not really. Yes, all right, she could no longer button the top of her jeans, a fact she hid by wearing loose hoodies. But it wasn't like the furniture shook when she crossed the room. Lunch was watery porridge with a side of peaches, dished out from yet another can. It fell to Nelson Heinrich to dispense the lottery tickets, and he turned up to do the job wearing one of his Christmas sweaters, dark green with gingerbread men dancing across it. He wore a Santa cap, too, an obscene touch in Harper's opinion, as if he were handing out candy canes and not taking away meals. The tickets were piled in a woman's brown leather purse. The losing tickets had black X's marked on them. Harper thought that purse was some kind of karmic opposite to the sorting hat. Instead of being sent to Slytherin or Gryffindor, you were sent off to go hungry with a cup of sweet coffee. You wouldn't even be allowed to stay in the cafeteria with the others. "I don't think that would be a good idea," Ben Patchett had explained. "If we let the losers stay, folks will take pity and start sharing. Normally, I'm all for share and share alike. But in this case, it would defeat the whole purpose of the lottery. There's so little to split. If people begin dividing their portions, it'll be like no one's getting fed at all." Then he said there would only be 29 losing tickets in the purse. He had decided to take the 30th, to show he wasn't asking anyone to do anything he wasn't ready to do himself. At 2 a.m., their normal lunchtime, Norma slid back the bolt on the cafeteria doors and stood aside as people began to push in, snow-dusting their caps and shoulders. It was coming down again in a fast, light, powdery flurry. Don Lewiston was at the head of the line, and he made his way up to Nelson Heinrich. Nelson blinked at him in surprise.
"Don, you're 63. You don't need to draw a ticket. I didn't, and I'm only 60. Go on and get your peaches. I already had mine. Gosh, they were yummy."
"I'll draw a ticket same as any t'others here, thank you, Nelson. I've never been a big eater anyway, and would almost rather a cup of coffee with some sugar."
Before Don could stick his hand in the purse, Allie slipped up alongside him and grabbed his wrist. "Mr. Lewiston, I'm sorry. If you could just wait a minute. We've got a mess of lookouts who have been out in the cold all night, sweeping off the boards between houses. Father Story said it would be all right if they drew first," Allie said. She looked away from Don, down along the line, and gestured with her head. Teenagers began to shuffle toward the front. Someone shouted,
"Hey, what's with the cutting in line? Everyone here is hoping to get some lunch."
Allie ignored him. So did Michael, and the kids coming along behind him. Michael eased around Don Lewiston with a nod, reached into the purse, and came up with a white stone the size of a robin's egg.
"Huh," he said. "Look at that. I think I drew a loser."
He popped the stone in his mouth and walked past the line of serving windows onto the coffee bar. There he silently poured a cup of coffee for himself and held out his ceramic mug so Harper could dump in his sugar. Nelson Heinrich stared after him, mouth lolling open in a rather witless way. He looked down into the purse, trying to figure out where the stone had come from. Allie began to whistle a jaunty little tune. Jillian Neighbors drew next. Another stone.
"Just my luck," she said happily, and plopped the stone in her mouth. She walked on to Harper, poured a coffee, and waited for her sugar. Behind her, Her sister, Gail, was reaching into the purse, and this time Harper could see she already had the stone in her palm, even before she began to dig around among the tickets. Harper wanted to laugh. She wanted to clap. She felt like a girl filled with helium, so light she might have come free from the floor and bumped up against the ceiling like a balloon. She ached with happiness. A fierce, bright happiness of a sort she had not felt in all the time she had been sick with dragon scale. She wanted to start grabbing the kids, the lookouts, Allie's friends, and squeezing them. And not only because of what they were doing, foregoing the lottery and simply volunteering to do without, taking it upon themselves to skip lunch so others could eat. It was just as much what Allie was whistling, a song Harper recognized from the first three bars, a melody so sweet she felt it might break her in two, just as a glass can be shattered by certain musical tones. Allie was whistling A Spoonful of Sugar, the very best song from the very best movie ever. Gail Neighbors drew the white stone, made a clucking sound, and walked on to get her coffee. All the kids were doing it, Allie's kids. All the teenage girls who had shaved their heads to look like her, and all the teenage boys who had signed up for lookout duty just to be around her. Don Lewiston pushed back his Greek fisherman's cap and scratched his forehead with his thumb and began to whistle himself. He nodded as each lookout walked past to collect a stone and skip their lunch. Father Story was whistling, too. Harper had not seen him enter, but there he was, standing to one side of the door, smiling enormously, but blinking at tears. Aunt Carol stood beside him, her head resting on his shoulder, whistling with the rest of them, and her eyes were gold coins. Almost a dozen people were whistling the song now, the melody as lovely as the first warm, perfumed breath of spring, and their eyes shone like lamps, burning gently on the inside, burning with song, with the bright. Gail Neighbors held out her mug for sugar. As Harper dumped it in, she began to sing. "Just a spoonful of sugar," Harper sang, her voice thick with emotion. "Makes the medicine go down, makes the medicine go down." She sang, and for a moment forgot all about being pregnant, being fat, being lonely, being covered in some kind of flammable spore that was ready to ignite. She sang and forgot Jacob's awful book and Jacob's awful gun. She forgot the world was on fire. A spoke of heat flashed up from the base of her spine and spread over the ribbons of dragon scale on her skin in a sweet, shiver-inducing rush. She swayed on her heels without being aware of it. The world possessed a new, liquid quality. She was conscious of a tidal rocking in her blood, as if she were afloat in a pool of warmth and light, as if she were an embryo herself, not the carrier of one. The next time she poured sugar, the glittering grain seemed to fall in slow motion, a cascade of riches. Brightness cascaded along the dragon scale around her wrists and throat, a silvery white trill. She was a kite, filled and rising with song instead of wind. She was as warm as a kite in the sun, too, her skin blazing, not painfully, but with a flush of pleasure. Her hand wore a glove of light. The lookouts came and nodded to her, and took their coffee or tea, and went on, and they all shone. They were all lit up like ghosts. She was glad for each of them, in love with each of them, although she could not remember who any of them were. She could not remember anything that had come before the song. She could not think of anything that mattered more than the melody. She did not believe that any spoonful of sugar, no matter how sweet, could be as fine as the melting sweetness running through her then. Father Story was the last to come up for coffee. He had drawn a stone himself, of course. He hadn't put it in his mouth yet, was just holding it. "There is Miss Willows," he cried, "happy at last, happy and looking well." "Miss Willows?" she asked, her voice as slow and dreamy as sugar spilling from a spoon. "Who's Miss Willows?" "It'll come back to you," he promised. 13. It did, too. Her name returned to her just before dawn, came back to her almost as soon as she stopped trying to remember it. Her subconscious coughed it up without any warning, in much the way it would sometimes supply her with the answer to a question in a crossword that had been stumping her. She did not wake coughing smoke again. There were no more hot flashes burning up her t-shirts in the night. At the next chapel, Carol sat at the pipe organ to play Spirit in the Sky, and the congregation rose to sing. They roared and stamped like drunk sailors in a Melville story, full of grog and scaring the seagulls with their sea chanties. And Harper bellowed with them, bellowed till her throat ached. And they shone, all of them together, Harper too. Her eyes blazed like lamps, her skin hummed with warmth and pleasure. Her thought soared away from her like a kestrel rising on a hot summer updraft. And for a few weeks, everything was almost all right. Book 3. Speak of the Devil. January 1. She woke on the second day of January, not from a nightmare, but to a sensation of something shifting inside her, pushing out against the muscles of her abdomen. Harper lay awake in the darkness, eyes wide open, her hands spread across the taut gourd of her stomach. A bony protrusion, about the size of a thumb knuckle, pressed up from within, rising against her right palm. "Hey, you," she whispered. 2. The night the locket went missing, Renee and Harper were listening to the Marlboro Man on a battery-powered radio.
"I don't understand how you can stand that man." Norma Held was passing by their cots and had paused to hear what they had on. "Every word is a drop of poison in your ears." Renee said, "He's the closest thing to local news left."
"More importantly," Harper told her, "we're awful women, and his awfulness excites us.
The more awful, the better."
"Yes," Renee said, "that too."
Harper was planting kisses on squares of parchment paper, trying out various shades of lipstick. After a kiss, she would wipe her mouth clean and try another. Renee had collected different lipsticks from everyone in the basement. When Harper made a pleasant lipstick print, she would hand it off to Renee, who would roll it around a cinnamon stick or a fragrant piece of shriveled lemon peel and tuck it into a little glass bottle and cork it up. These were emergency kisses. Harper was stocking the portable mother with them so that when her son needed a kiss, he would have plenty to choose from. The portable mother was no longer a book, but a package, a whole collection of potentially useful items, which had swelled to occupy Harper's entire carpet bag. Nick was underfoot, playing Yahtzee against himself. Dice rattled and crashed inside the plastic cup. The basement was crowded, loud with conversation, argument, laughter, creaking bedsprings, everyone trapped in close quarters while it snowed heavily outside. On the radio, the Marlboro Man said,
"You think a girl with dragon scale can blow smoke rings with her vajayjay? Friend? I always wondered about that myself." Well, this weekend, the Marlboro Man was on the loose in Portsmouth with the Seacoast Incinerators and had a chance to find out. I'll tell you all about it in a minute, but first, here's a story from Concord. Governor Ian Judd Skiller said members of the National Guard were only defending themselves when they shot and killed 11 burners yesterday on the Canadian border. The mob charged the barricade with sticks, not white flags, as has been reported elsewhere, and the besieged soldiers opened fire to disperse.
"He's a murderer," Norma said and sniffed. "That DJ you're listening to. He's killed people like us, and he boasts about it. Hemlock in your ears, that's what he is."
"Yes," Renee said. "He's very stupid, you know. That's another reason to listen. The more we know about him, the less likely he'll ever know anything about us. People call in with tips and this bozo airs them live. If anyone ever mentions Camp Wyndham or points him in our direction, we'll have a head start. And even if they don't call in, I've learned all kinds of things about the cremation crew he runs with, just by paying attention to his program. I've learned it's made up of 8 men and women, and that 2 are former military and were able to supply some heavy ordnance. A 50 caliber something? I gather that's a pretty big gun. I know they travel in 2 vehicles, a van and a big orange truck.
I know they have a police scanner, and most of the time, local law enforcement is happy to...
Orange truck? Harper asked. You mean like a town truck?
Across the room, Allie screamed, No, no! And flipped her cot with an echoing bang. Every head turned, except for Nick's, of course, since he had heard nothing.
Allie kicked over a battered suitcase, dumping filthy laundry on the floor.
Fuck! She screamed. Fuck! Fuck, 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 fuck!
Conversations petered out. Emily Waterman, barely 11, a girl who had outlived her entire family and who had pretty feathers of dragon scale on the backs of her freckled arms, climbed under her cot and covered her ears. Renee was the first to move, her round, pleasant face remaining entirely calm. Harper was two steps behind her. Renee slowed as she approached Allie, moving toward her in much the same way she might have attempted to get near a feral cat. Harper sank to her knees to look under Emily Waterman's bed.
Emily, everything is okay, Harper said, reaching out for her. In a whisper, she added, Allie is being a fusspot.
But Emily shook her head and shrank from Harper's hand. Harper wished she had her Mary Poppins lunchbox with its individually wrapped candies and emergency radish.
Allie, Renee said, what's wrong?
It's gone! It's fucking gone!
What's gone? What did you lose?
I didn't lose anything. My locket was under my pillow, and now it isn't because one of you bitches took it!
She glared around the basement. Emily made a thin squeal of terror and turned her face from Harper's outstretched hand. Harper considered trying to pull her out for a hug, decided that might be too alarming, and settled for reaching under to stroke her back. Renee said,
Allie, I know you're upset, but you need to lower your voice.
I don't need to do shit.
Because you're frightening the little ones.
Why don't you ask Nick? I asked him. Don't you think I asked him when I started looking for it 15 minutes ago?
A tendril of pale smoke trickled from under one pant leg of Emily Waterman's baggy overalls.
Allie, Harper said, stop it. You're giving Emily the smokes.
Please, Allie, Renee said, putting a hand on Allie's shoulder. We've all been under so much pressure, you wouldn't be human if you didn't sometimes want to scream. But if you'll sit down with me...
Will you stop touching me?
Allie cried. She shrugged off Renee's hand.
You don't know anything about me. You aren't my mother. My mother burned to death. You are no one to me. You are not my mother and you are not my friend. You're a pain vulture who circles around and around looking for someone to feed off. That's why you spend all your free time reading to the kids. You love their wounded little hearts. You feed off their loneliness just like a vampire. You love kids with no parents because they need someone. It's easy to read them a story to make yourself feel special. But you aren't special. Stop feeding off us all.
A stunned silence fell upon the basement. Harper wanted to say something, but had lost the trick of speech. She was not sure if she had been silenced by her horror. She had never imagined Allie, who was so daring, so clever, so beautiful, and so funny, could be so cruel, or by a crippling wave of déjà vu. For when Allie insisted altruism was really selfishness, and kindness a form of manipulation, she sounded just like Jacob. She had all his savage powers of logic. It made a person feel naive and childish for imagining there could be any good in the world at all. For herself, Renee had lifted an arm to protect her face, as if she expected to be struck. She studied Allie with a mute, wounded fascination. The room was still waiting for her to reply, to defend herself, when Nick charged across the basement, inserting himself between Allie and Renee. He held up his Yahtzee scorecard, turned over to the back, where he had written, Two Yahtzees in a row! Allie stared at this message with blank incomprehension. Then she took the sheet of paper from his hands, balled it up, and threw it in his face. It bounced off his forehead and onto the floor. Nick staggered backward, as if he had been shoved. His shoulder thumped into Renee's breast. Harper did not think she had ever seen so much naked hurt in a face before. He ran. Before anyone could catch him, he flew to the stairs. He hesitated at the bottom of the steps for one last look at his older sister.
and for a moment he fixed her with a glare of contempt as fierce as anything Allie herself could produce. Like their elfin good looks, a gift for hate was, perhaps, something that ran in the family. Harper called his name, called for him to wait. But of course Nick didn't, couldn't, hear her. Harper rose to go after him, but he had already dashed up the stairs, banged through the door at the top, and launched himself into the falling snow. She turned a frustrated look upon Allie.
"What? What? You got something to say, Nurse Nobody?" Allie asked her.
"Yes," Harper said, summoning up all the Juliandras she had in her heart. "A bad show, Allie. A very bad show. He also lost his mother, you know, and you are all he has left. For shame. After he threw 2 Yahtzees."
Allie's response to this shocked Harper more than anything else. Her face crumpled, and she began to sob. She sat down hard, with her back against the springs of her overturned bed. At this sudden display of defeat, the neighbor's twins, Jamie Close, and all the other members of Allie's unofficial, unnamed sorority, that society of orphan girls with shaved heads, flocked to her side. Even Emily Waterman scuttled out from under her cot and ran over to throw her arms around Allie's neck. Girls took her hands and sat beside her, whispering soothingly and fussing over her. Gale neighbors began to quietly pick up her things. One entering the room would have imagined Allie was the person who had just been bullied and humiliated, not Renee or Nick. Harper returned to her cot, which was at a right angle to Renee's. Renee was already sitting on the edge of her mattress by then, looking as worn and disheartened as Harper felt.
"Should one of us go after Nick?" Renee asked.
"I don't think so. He won't go far in the snow. The lookouts will yell if he so much as steps off the planks. One of them will bring him back eventually." The Marlboro man was still chattering, saying something about a woman who had smelled like a wet cat when she burned. He seemed offended that she had the bad grace to stink when she died. Talk radio was enough to make Harper think the end of the world wasn't so bad after all.
"I can't take any more," Renee said.
And Harper thought she was speaking of life in the camp, but she only meant the DJ. Renee reached out and, with an irritated flick, switched the radio to AM and began to skip through bands of static. Harper said, "What are you doing? Why are people in this camp always listening to static? What are you all listening for?"
"Martha Quinn," Renee said.
"Martha Quinn? Martha Quinn, who used to be on MTV 1,000 years ago?"
"She's out there, somewhere."
"Lies," Norma Held murmured. "All lies. That's a pipe dream."
Renee ignored her. "You know what the kids say."
"I have no idea what the kids say. What do they say?"
"She came back from the 80s to save mankind. Martha Quinn is our only hope."
3.
"I've never heard the broadcast myself, but supposedly she's transmitting from off the coast of Maine."
Renee struggled into a bulky orange parka. It was later. Women milled around the bottom of the basement steps, picking coats and hats out of cardboard boxes, readying themselves for the 300-foot march through the snow to the cafeteria and supper. Outside, the wind screamed.
"From a boat?" "From an island. They've got a little town and their own research lab, backed by the federal government. What's left of the federal government, anyway. They're testing experimental treatments."
Jamie Close grinned, showing snaggled teeth, 2 incisors missing from the lower part of her mouth.
"They've got a serum they give to you in 18 shots, like for rabies. It suppresses the dragon scale, but they need to give it to you every day. Bend over, drop your pants, and bite on this stick, because you're getting it right in the ass. I say no thank you to that. If I wanted someone poking painful things in my ass every day, I've got an uncle I could look up."
Harper had a scarf over her mouth, wound around and around the lower part of her face, and she felt this gave her permission not to reply. She squeezed into the crowd of women making their way up the steps, out into the darkness and the shrieking gale.
"It's not as bad as that," murmured Gale Neighbors. At least Harper thought it was Gale Neighbors. It would have been difficult to tell the twins apart under any circumstances, but with the hat pulled to her eyebrows and the puffy collar of her parka up around her ears, Harper could hardly see any of her face. Apparently they're doing great things with medical marijuana. Everyone gets an allowance, 7 joints a week. Government-bred weed, so it's really clean, really mellow. Also, the legal drinking age there is 16, said the one Harper thought was Jillian. They had both turned 16, Harper recalled, just after Thanksgiving. The pressure of the crowd behind Harper ejected her out of the stairwell and into the night. A pair of planks ran alongside each other, across the snow, dwindling off into the darkness. The salty gale battered at Harper, caused her to stagger. She wasn't as steady on her pins as she had been a couple of months ago. Her center of gravity was shifting. She steadied herself against a boulder wearing a white cap of snow. The neighbor's girls passed her, went on ahead. Emily Waterman skipped along behind them, and Harper heard her saying, "They have ice cream on Fridays, homemade ice cream, 3 flavors, strawberry, vanilla, and I think coffee. Coffee is my favorite." "Ice cream every day," promised one of the neighbor's girls. "Ice cream for breakfast," said the other, and then they were gone into the night. Allie took Harper's elbow, helped her to stand straight. "Think Nick went to the cafeteria?" Allie asked in a low, dispirited voice. He hadn't returned to the dorm, hadn't been seen since running out. "I don't know," Harper said. "Probably." "Think Renee will ever talk to me again?" "I think you'll feel better as soon as you apologize." "Don Lewiston knows where it is."
"Where what is?"
"The island. Martha Quinn's island. At least he thinks he knows. He showed me on a map once. He says based on all the information, it's probably Timber Wolf Island, off Machias."
"So he's heard the broadcast?"
"No."
"Have you?"
"No."
"Has anyone heard Martha Quinn?"
"No," said Carol Story, before Allie could reply.
They had reached an intersection beyond Monument Park, where the path from the chapel met a series of planks extending from the woods. Carol emerged from the snow, which was whipping almost sideways, her father behind her. She led him as if he were a child, holding his mittened hand.
"You ask everyone in camp," Carol Story said. "It's always someone else who has heard it. And if it makes them feel better to have a perfect safe haven to daydream about, what's wrong with that? I've caught myself going through the AM band sometimes, too. But I'll tell you what, even if she's out there, Martha Quinn doesn't have anything we need. We've already got everything we need, right here."
Harper stamped into the cafeteria, snow falling off her boots in wet white clumps. Father Story flapped his coat and a small blizzard fell around his legs. She cast her gaze around for Nick and didn't see him. They collected trays and moved along the line to be served. Father Story said,
"I always had a bit of a crush on Martha Quinn, in her bright vests and skinny ties. There's something about a woman in a tie. You just want to grab it and pull her over for a squeeze."
He winked. Norma Held dished him a scoop of ravioli. The sauce had the consistency of mud.
"Norma, this looks delightful. Is it your own recipe?"
"It's Chef Boyardee," Norma said.
"Wonderful," he cried, and shuffled along to get himself some Ritz crackers.
Norma rolled her eyes to watch him go, then looked back to Harper. She collected another scoop of ravioli, but instead of dumping it into Harper's bowl, she waved the big serving spoon at her.
"I remember when she was on TV, Martha Quinn, teaching little girls to dress like tiny whores. Her and Madonna and the one with the hair like cotton candy, Cyndi Lauper. People like Martha Quinn are the reason this world is being scourged by fire. You ask yourself if God would let such a woman live and make her his voice, calling his people to safety. Look in your heart. You know he wouldn't. She is gone and Madonna is gone, and every moneylender in New York City who got rich turning little girls into prostitutes is gone. You know it and I know it."
The ravioli fell from the spoon into Harper's bowl with a thick, wet schlop. "I doubt very much that God harbors anti-Semitic views toward New York City or anywhere else, Norma," Harper told her. "Seeing as he called the Jews his own chosen people, that seems highly unlikely.
Have you seen Nick? Did he come in for dinner?"
Norma Held gave her a glazed, dull, unfriendly look.
Haven't seen him. Why don't you go outside and yell for him?
He's deaf, Harper said.
Don't let that stop you.